We'd like to get started and like to welcome you this morning and to remind you that to get into the sessions you have to have your pre-printed name tag that you can pick up at the registration desk. This morning, Michael Hicks will present his paper, The Sacred and the Profuse, and the response will be given by Sterling Van Wagenen, Director of the Sundance Film Institute. Michael Hicks received his Bachelor of Music at Brigham Young University, his Master of Music at University of Illinois, and is presently completing his dissertation for Doctor of Musical Arts degree at University of Illinois. He's been published in Sunstone, Perspectives of New Music, and will be forthcoming in Dialogue, BYU Studies, and is working on a set of commemorative essays on Wagner. He has taught music at many levels, and right now he's working on a soybean farm, tending children, and writing music. I'll give you my comment.
On the 8th of April, 1843, in a windy grove at Nauvoo, Joseph Smith spoke to his people about John's Book of Revelation, explaining the difference between John's writings and passages of Daniel and Ezekiel. Joseph observed that the old prophets do not declare that they saw a beast or beasts, but that they saw the image or figure of a beast. They did not see an actual bear or lion, but the images or figures of those beasts. The translation, I'm still quoting Joseph here, the translation should have been rendered image instead of beast in every instance where beasts are mentioned by the prophets. But John saw the actual beast in heaven. Close quote. As he said this, Joseph could surely not help recalling his own visionary experiences, even back to the renowned first vision, an occurrence that would later represent for us the very birth of the Latter-day Gospel. Joseph had not been so careful with his terms in describing the appearance of the Father and the Son, as he was about the appearance of so many beasts. In that earlier grove in Palmyra, had he envisioned by the Spirit, or had he been in fact visited by God and Christ? He had written to John Wentworth of being enwrapped in a heavenly vision. In another place he said that the Lord opened the heavens unto me. Was there a difference here, such as he found between the visionary beasts of the Hebrew prophets and the real heavenly beasts John saw? From the moment he came to himself again, lying on his back, looking up into heaven, to that moment on the grove stand of Nauvoo, Joseph must have mused within himself whether, as he gazed upon the Father and the Son, he was seeing the actual or the image. Across the sea, 2 months before Joseph spoke in Nauvoo's Grove, Ludwig Feuerbach wrote a preface to the second edition of his book, The Essence of Christianity, which contained a modern application of the same kind of distinction that Joseph had made. He wrote that the people of his era preferred the image to the thing, the copy to the original, the representation to the reality, and appearance to being. He, like Joseph, his American contemporary, was heir to a view of the world that was quite content to distinguish between image and actuality. But both Joseph and Herr Feuerbach were speaking and writing just at the moment when Louis Daguerre was entering his heyday of image making. Forsaking painting in favor of his new photographic process, the daguerreotype, Daguerre soon mesmerized the Western world with the exactest of representations. The age of mechanical reproduction of images, what we sometimes call the media age, waited in the wings. This new era, our era, would be one in which the clear distinction between image and actuality would begin to fade. Two things separated the new medium of photography from old image-making media. First was the conquest of exactitude. the perfect accuracy of image that portrait painters, engravers, and sculptors had tried through skill and cultivated craft to achieve was now a moot goal. Anyone with the proper apparatus could, by hardly an effort, create an exact replication of what was seen. Removing a long-standing obstacle, photography pushed artists into new realms of imagination and abstraction. The depiction of objective reality became a job for hirelings. The second triumph of the new medium was what Paul Valéry called the conquest of ubiquity. For not only could objects be turned into images by mechanical means, the images so made could be copied and sent anywhere. The original object, the actual, became, in Valéry's words, a kind of source or point of origin whose benefits will be available wherever we wish. Just as water, gas, and electricity are brought into our houses from far off to satisfy our needs in response to a minimal effort, so we shall be supplied with visual or auditory images which will appear and disappear at a simple movement of the hand, hardly more than a sign. The actual, transformed into these vagrant images, thus loses its specific existence in space and time. All boundary, all enclosure dissipates. The twin conquest of exactitude and ubiquity give these new media, that is, photography first, later movies, sound recording, broadcasting, and so forth, their power to confuse the actual and the image. The church has been far from oblivious to the new media. On the contrary, it has embraced them as heartily as has the world. The world seeks these media as means of coping with the overriding condition of modern man, what Ortega y Gasset simply calls plenitude. That is, a sense of fullness to the world and the specter of the multitude in every locale. The church faces its own problems of plenitude. You will recall that President Kimball, in his first conference address as president of the church, said, "Our greatest problem is our rapid growth." Such growth, characteristic of adolescence, frightens us. Rapid growth in the ancient church destroyed the true faith. To the modern church, scant as it is in liturgy, the new media seem like salvation. They make things standard by clothing the body of Christ with electronically and mechanically produced images. The profusion of standard images in the temple, in the chapel, and in the saints' homes serves a ritual function. The profuse becomes the sacred, that which creates order from chaos, cosmicizes the international church, fills unpatterned space with divine patterns. But when we speak of ritual, we mean something by which we can imitate the divine pattern of things in order to achieve it. We seek by ritual to find the regularity beneath the random surface of life, and we attempt to reveal and embody what really is the being, as it were, behind becoming. In ritual, to quote Eliade, reality is a function of the imitation of a celestial archetype. And by ritual we gain power over the unruly course of time. In the repetition of sacred gestures and the reenactment of mythic happenings, time submits to a fixed order of events and becomes indefinitely recoverable and infinitely repeatable. Just as archaic man acts out his rites, modern man takes pictures. He pursues the beautiful, the ideal, and when he finds it, he shoots it, the ultimate taming. At the end, at the aim of a camera, the actual is brought down into a fixed image. Like ritualistic temple and city building, photography helps us to, and I use Susan Sontag's words here, to take possession of space in which we are insecure by turning that space into small, manageable objects. The photo frame, like the building frame, and for the same reasons, attempts to give a regular shape to existence. Moreover, photography ritualistically seizes hold of time and reduces it to a set of images we may continually refer to. These images objectify our memory. They preserve the details of youth long after old age has set in, and they make our pleasant hours tangible, that they may provide refuge during our unpleasant ones. The church takes a great many pictures for us, mass reproducing them in a stream of booklets, manuals, and magazines. Certain images prevail, of course. Photographs usually capture families at home, teenagers engaged in wholesome activities, study, sports, helping neighbors, priesthood holders doing church assignments, women doing womanly things, general authorities, popular religious paintings, and church buildings, especially temples. Now, pictures of temples fill an essential symbolic role in the church, one almost as important in the saints' everyday lives as the temple itself. For once we have taken a snapshot of a temple, we have taken control, as it were, over a portion of sacred space. By hanging it on the wall or putting it into an album, we incorporate the sacred space into the house space. But mass reproduced photographs of sacred objects like temples, especially photographs taken from inside them and distributed in booklets to temple goers and tourists alike, leave stumbling blocks for the psyche. I've given names to two related obstacles, the disruption of sacred space and the waning of the aura. Let me explain them. Everything that represents tries to inspire awe of the original. A photograph does this as much as or more than any representation. We often have to validate an event or object by photographing it because, as we say, the camera doesn't lie. The camera records light as it is. It is legal, even court-sanctioned evidence of what is. But a photograph is more than just a representation. It is also a fragment of the original. It is built from light particles that have emanated from the object itself. The photograph presents an image that is a sort of imprint of the original. It is like the skin of an onion or of a shedding snake. A photograph thus attains its power by a kind of sympathetic magic, for it proves by its very existence that it has been near to its subject. It is a relic of the object or event it depicts. When we view a photograph, we experience sensations akin to those we would experience in the original's presence because we're only once removed from that presence. Elizabeth Barrett wrote of this to a friend as early indeed as 1843. She wrote of a daguerreotype she possessed. It is not merely the likeness which is precious in such cases, but the association and the sense of nearness involved in the thing, the fact of, and she underlines this, the very shadow of the person lying there fixed forever. It is the very sanctification of portraits, I think. Close quote. The inside of a temple must be holy ground. Temple space is space that has been consecrated and made stable by being symbolically aligned with the heavenly pattern and blessed with the presence of God. Its walls shut out the uncosmicized world within those walls we find true enclosure. When the appearance of that enclosure is, in effect, stenciled by photography into thousands of books and pamphlets so that we may examine and contemplate them at will, sacred space is disrupted. The profusion of images copied from the actual object, the temple, turns us back to chaos. The space of the temple is turned into an image, not to mention reduced, cropped, and so on. An image for the consumption of the profane world, literally the world outside the temple, for that is the meaning of the word profane. Being within the temple is an experience for which we must be recommended, as we know, and initiated. Photographs turn the temple inside out, leaving consecrated space on display for all. That the stewards of the temples themselves should market these photographs is a singular irony. For while we're enjoined to speak little of the temple outside its walls, each picture is worth a thousand words. The sensations evoked so powerfully by the accuracy of the photograph may seem worth the disruption of sacred space. Our desire to impart the blessings of being inside the temple impels us to do everything possible to excite others to want to come inside too. But each photograph image we take from the temple is, as I see it, like a layer of power skimmed off. The sensations evoked by the image reduce or at best distort the sensations evoked by the actual thing. The inspiration we feel from a sacred image interrupts pure communion with the original. This is especially true of a sacred image we see many times before encountering its actual counterpart. We're conditioned to respond to the image. After repeated encounters with the medium, we subconsciously come to venerate it along with the object being mediated. The representative medium then becomes a kind of decoy. We lose the ability to wholly separate image and actuality. Thereafter, when we encounter the original object without the medium, for example, the actual temple walls we have only seen in pictures, we sense a great psychological gap, an abyss where the absent medium once stood. It's just as a 1975 Polaroid ad put it, "Suddenly you see a picture everywhere you look." This is one reason why, when we first see a celebrated temple, such as the one here in Salt Lake City, most of us immediately take a picture. We shoot the temple, and so doing, we momentarily obtain power over it, making the image of the temple our own. And as we gain power over the temple by photography, the temple's aura begins to wane. One truth taught us within the temple is that the disembodied voice, that speech whose mouth is behind the veil, wields power. The scriptures confirm this. Most divine communications come by a voice speaking without a speaker who is seen. Go back to Genesis. After the fall, Adam and Eve heard the voice of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. God called to them. While Adam confessed, "I heard thy voice and I was afraid." Later, God accused Cain upon the evidence that the voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. Since the fall of man and the first murder, we grope about in a shadow world, the divine all but lost to sight, yet present in the disembodied voice. Moses is called by a voice from a flaming bush. Jesus' call is confirmed by a voice at his baptism, and again later in his life, where some, as it says, merely thought that it thundered. The Old Testament Saul is called by a clear voice in the night. The New Testament Saul is called by a voice in the day, accompanied by a strange light. Incidentally, Joseph Smith, believing and understanding the divine principle, harmonized both accounts of Saul or Paul's vision to show that the light could be seen by all who were present, but the sacred portion, the voice itself, was heard by Paul alone. Radio incorporates the power of the disembodied voice. The voice that we hear while, to use a scriptural phrase, while seeing no man, obtains its influence over us because we've been divinely programmed to respond to such a voice. Certain political leaders have demonstrated this quasi-divinity of the radio voice. Think of Churchill, FDR, and especially Hitler. The golden age of radio signaled a renewal of despotism because the medium itself awakens impulses of obedience in our spirits. Beside empowering the voice, radio enabled music to reach the ears of all while leaving its source veiled. It became, that is, the embodiment of heavenly music, strains which emanate from an invisible realm. The ancients understood all music as a cosmic power. The 19th century romantics tried to revive this notion. Wagner, attempting what technology had not yet devised, placed the Bayreuth Orchestra in a pit in order that the music would rise, as he says, like vapors rising from the holy womb of Gaia beneath the Pythia's tripod. Radio fulfilled the romantic dream of music with no visible source. In a bizarre twist of fate, Wagner's own Parsifal, which he never intended should be performed outside the temple he built for it at Bayreuth, was the first music ever broadcast over radio. His music gained then the mystic imminence that he was seeking, but at the same time the sacred enclosure of the Festspielhaus was dissolved, that is, the sacred became the profuse. As it pushed beyond the experimental stages, radio achieved a programming with the regularity of liturgy. The daily cycle of the wireless became a kind of monastic office for profane man. Each day's broadcast had standard personalities, programs, and repetitive formulae, commercials. Each day had its schedule that could be counted on, and the week as a fixed cycle was reaffirmed. Each day and each hour of the day took on its peculiar role in the culture. In this way, the radio listener ritually possessed and controlled time. Radio also became, in effect, to use a scriptural phrase of Paul's, the prince of the power of the air. Whether in music or in the spoken word, radio's voice was not a still small one, but a ponderously mighty one. We may sense the transcendent power of radio as we drive across the desert late at night, as I've recently done, tuned to a strong signal. That signal becomes a supernatural point of stability in the wilderness. Or we may deduce the omnipotence of radio from its very omnipresence. Rudolf Arnheim wrote a wonderful passage about this in 1936. He describes the reader of his book, which is called Radio, sitting and listening while he reads. And I'll cite Arnheim now. There is silence, except for slight noises and cracklings. The reader closes the book and gets ready to go out, and suddenly an entirely different voice from the loudspeaker announces that he will now hear Beethoven's Eighth Symphony. The reader puts on his coat and cuts off Beethoven's introductory bars in the middle by a pressure of his finger. But the music persists, though more distant and raucous, drifting up the stair from the hall porter's room. The reader nods to him as he goes past, bangs the front door, but Beethoven follows him down the street, loud and strident from the shoemaker's back room, softly from the second floor of a villa, and braying across the marketplace from a little cafe, an acoustic relay race carried on from house to house, everywhere inescapable. Busy and idle, he says, rich and poor, young and old, healthy and sick, they all hear the same thing. With such language, Arnheim was forecasting the coming of cultural hell. The church, though, prophesied the triumph of Zion through the ubiquitous voice of radio. Its omnipresence was a promise, not a threat. For by radio, the church could leaven the masses with its oral messages, just as it had suffused its visual images, only with greater authority, the dominion of the disembodied voice. By radio, the church could create all that the word network implies, a structure in which members could be interconnected and ultimately tied to a single line. The broadcasting of general conferences seemed to convene universal meetings of the saints. In these meetings, the voices of church leaders took on the generalized authority of the radio medium. Their strictures became more powerful than if written on stone tablets, at least for the moment, and their encouragement and humor became ever more inspirational. To hear their voices at all was a miracle, and that sense of the miraculous present in the medium was transferred to the church leaders who spoke. How the voices were heard enhanced what was being said. The modern miraculous descends to us in the guise of television. This young medium is an extension of radio and a diminution of it as well. Most television programming in its early days, as you're probably aware, resembled nothing so much as radio with visual accompaniment. But the astonishing images, mistrustful of the audience's imagination, partially embodied the voice of radio, rather deadening, I think, its quasi-divine power. Television arrived also as a stepchild of the automobile. It answers to our modern obsession with rapid transit and the exhilaration of pure speed. It does not bring us into the world, though, but, to quote a CBS slogan, brings the world home to us. It has become the principal medium of news, showing us pictures of far-off events and telling us about them, always in the quickest and most simplistic way. The images we watch are weak and gross. They lack the sharp definition of good film. Being watched through through a glass brightly, as it were, and being composed of a relatively small number of light bullets being shot at the screen many times a second. The way we watch television, I should say half-watch, suggests that deep involvement with the images is not part and parcel of that medium. The latest pocket and wristwatch televisions should demonstrate that television is above all a medium of convenience, a way of getting a few essentials without fussing over details. It gives us an encyclopedic, if not rankly textbookish, vision of the world, the highlights without the nuances, the bones without the flesh. The church uses television in several ways. To grasp at greater accuracy and representation during conference broadcasts, to send forth inspirational commercials that teach principles in the way best suited to television, catchphrases, lightning-quick portrayals of complex situations, and so on, and to make videotapes for saints throughout the world to watch. These tapes are the modern versions of the tract. They are convenient, lively, and simply stated. Because of the inattentiveness we've cultivated toward television, such video religious texts are not relied on to teach hard concepts or deep theology. They best display gospel essentials. With the force of low definition, high energy advertisements, they stamp our minds with the eternal basic. Sometimes we really do watch television. We get serious, we put out the lights and focus on the frame of the glowing tube. At such times, television becomes what the poet Anne Waldman calls a surrogate moon. Let me explain this. Man has an instinct to stare at cosmic lights in the darkness, the moon, the planets, and the stars. They evoke sensations of awe and inspiration and seem to speak directly to the spirit. The ancients studied the heavens for a primal fascination and organized their stargazing into a science that tried to explain the expectancy they felt from the lights of the sky. But along with this wonder of celestial light came the terror of infinite space. There was nothing so frightening as area without bounds. It was the void, chaos. The recent capture of electrical power represented an awesome taming of the cosmic forces. Now, man could replicate the sun, however vaguely, and turn on the lights whenever he wished. In real television watching, that is, gazing at the lit tube in an otherwise dark room, we're fascinated by the solitary light, but are freed from the terror of infinite space. We keep our moon indoors. The electric cord is a leash. The television screen is bombarded by particles of light, as are our own retinae by natural light. The swirling dots of the television set, accompanied by their hiss and soft, high ringing, give us a controlled image of pure energy. We feel the quiet power of electrons as they're blown like a cloud of stars against the screen. The power seems to enter us like the light power of the natural world. The pulsations hypnotize us into believing we're ingesting this cosmic power. Light for us connotes truth. And a dense concentration of light suggests a convergence of truth. Our spirits are hence inclined, supposed, to confirm the images assembled by television light. The television screen becomes like the mirror written of in the scriptures, by which we, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory, are changed into the same image. We look to it for a vision of celestiality and become what we find. Our emotions begin to emulate the scripted processes on the screen, our relations with others devolving into episodes. We're told of extreme examples of this transformation on the television news itself. People acting out some violence they saw on a show because of the imposing power of the medium. But we all live with subtler examples, I believe, every day, hidden in our conversations, our gestures, and our thoughts. What television gives us, we receive as an image in our countenances. Many articles, editorials, and conference addresses on the subject of television have appeared in the church. Two themes recur. First, television is explained to be a fulfillment of many prophecies when the church uses it. Second, it is said to have a capacity for massive evil in others' hands. The same kinds of things are said in other discussions of mechanically and electronically reproductive media, when they are discussed at all. New media techniques must be accepted without qualification, for they are inspired by God. Content alone, we hear, determines the media's effects on people. In our necessary preoccupation with communicating as efficiently as possible, we have usually neglected one certain reality of photography, cinema, radio, and television, that what we experience are media methods and techniques and not content alone. We may not wish to resolve the question by a motto like "the medium is the message." Nevertheless, reproductive media reach deep into and manipulate our perception of the world. The modern media have supplanted and in some ways superseded old forms of ritual in bringing order from chaos. For this we may thank them tentatively. Their danger lies in their ability to rob us of both actual and image, the worlds of matter and of imagination. Let me explain this. As the media more and more occupy our attention, we surrender our senses on experience with people and with the earth. A second veil falls on our minds, our senses, as we partake or cut off from the earth, just as they have been from the heavenly world. Whether we are in the body or out of the body matters little. Ordinarily, when senses are deprived of direct contact with material things, either by our own choice or by others, our minds devise images, call them hallucinations, to fill the void. The media not only distract our senses from the things of the world that we can feel and smell and see and hear and taste, but they then fill the void themselves. Our internally generated images are blocked or curbed by outwardly imposed images. As Herr Feuerbach lamented, we yield up our perception of the actual for the sake of images, but images controlled by someone else's imagination and will. Instead of returning to reality or to private imagination, we grasp at ultimacy in media images, 3D, for example, very popular this summer, or so-called multimedia. We miss the feel of the actual, but are unwilling to give up the imposed images. What we should realize, for safety's sake, is that as media images roll into our minds, burdens roll onto our shoulders. These are the burdens of discernment, of choice, of temperance, and of clear thinking. There are two remarkable scriptural passages that suggest what God intends for man in his sensory and imaginary experience. The first was written by John. We know that when Christ shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. This was, we presume, written by that John who saw the actual beast and people living beyond the veil. Those were not just images without substance, according to Joseph, but beings to whose realm we should aspire. A second scriptural promise, one of a very different sort, was uttered by Joseph about William Law, who, in his apostasy, perhaps failed to obtain its fulfillment. One hopes that others may lay claim to it. He says, "And he shall mount up in the imagination of his thoughts as upon eagle's wings." Here, then, is a confirmation and sanction of the mind's power to conceive its own images and by them to be propelled into new regions of truth. If we can live for these promises of actuality and image, we may rise in the last day to find ourselves blessed with feeling bodies of flesh and bone and minds just as solid. Thank you.
First of all, let me say that the only major point of disagreement I have with Brother Hick's paper is that the church has embraced the media as hardly as the world has. And I think had that been the case, we may have more diverse and in some cases better results than we've had in the last dozen or so years. I have a general sympathy with almost everything that Brother Hicks has suggested to you in this paper, which includes a very healthy skepticism for the media in and of itself, in all of its diverse manifestations. However, I would like, in the very brief amount of time remaining, to shift the grounds of his argument slightly and offer two or three points for consideration. First of all, let me say that there seems to be a major concern nowadays, and I think Michael has expressed it very well, between the business of the actual versus the image. There's a lot of anxiety in people nowadays about artificially created needs, as the result of advertising, as the result of the profusion of media images, the separation from ourselves, between ourselves, as Michael noted, in the actual world, which, by the way, was first noted by Hegel in the first part of the 19th century. He recalled a great passage from the Odyssey that you all, I'm sure, know, that describes the Odysseus building a raft to escape from the island of Calypso. And in that discussion, Odysseus, of course, as he builds the raft, Homer describes in great detail how Odysseus cuts the wood, how he shapes it, how he forms it together. And Hegel's conclusion from that particular observation is, here's a man clearly, a poet clearly, who knew how to build a raft. And that sort of observation, I think, carries through much of the Odyssey as well as the Iliad. That is a separation that has not, the separation in that sense from the real world of our sense experience has not come purely as a result of the intrusion of media into our lives, but in fact has gathered momentum with the Industrial Revolution. It's a problem that goes back much further than the creation of film, television, radio, and photography. But in any case, let me ask the question, what is the original to which Brother Hick's paper refers? It seems to me that in defining ritual, he refers to the fact that it is, if you will, the repetition of certain practices which give us access to a divine pattern of experience. Now, ritual in and of itself, by that definition, either sacred or profane ritual, is, if you will, mimetic. That is to say, it mimics the divine pattern, but is itself not the divine pattern. Even our own experience of the temple points beyond itself to something larger to which we have access through our own faithfulness. I've heard Mormonism recently characterized by our own ubiquitous Hugh Nibley as a mystery religion. And the more one thinks about that phrase, the more power it has over one's mind, I think. And in that sense, as a mystery religion, the purpose of ritual in the church is, in fact, to point beyond itself to the revelation of a mystery, which is, of course, the knowledge of God. Now, one of the great difficulties, I think, in Brother Hick's paper is the fact that because the nature of ritual itself is mimetic, and because, if I can also refer to Brother Nibley again for a moment, he argues, sometimes convincingly, sometimes not so convincingly, that all of our experience in Western culture, all of our major institutions, art, political science, science itself, banking, agriculture, all of the institutions that we revere in our contemporary culture are ultimately derivative from the temple. It seems to follow from that point, I think, that no art form, if you will, and I want to talk about this further in just a moment, particularly if one looks at the media as having the potential of art form, which is not very often realized. No art form, if you will, or in fact no cultural institution can give us direct access to the divine pattern. In that sense, they're all derivative, all mimetic, and all point beyond themselves, sometimes very badly and sometimes rather effectively. So in that regard, when Brother Hicks, if you will, attacks media technique, I would extend that attack, in fact, to all of the arts in one form or another. That is to say, art by its definition is, in some sense, a search for a more basic reality. It is a search for that underlying pattern which links us with something larger than ourselves. Now, of course, in our own century, there are a number of artists who've turned their back on that assumption, but even by denying it, in some sense, they affirm it. If one thinks of the ways in which cultural habits of perception and seeing have been altered and, in fact, if you will, violated over the centuries by changes in the form of various arts, one immediately realizes that the media represent not so much a break with the history of Western art as simply an extension or intensification, if you will, with other forms. One thinks about the introduction of the third actor in Greek tragedy. One thinks about the violation of the Aristotelian unities by the French dramatists like Hugo, which caused enormous uproar in his own time, and in fact even riots in theaters. And one can project those kinds of concerns, I think, much further. One thinks of Masaccio and the invention of perspective and the kinds of problems that created in terms of cultural perspective at the beginning of the Renaissance. My mind also, as Michael was talking, went to the great difficulties the Catholic Church had in the reproduction of Scripture during the Reformation. One of the primary objections that Catholics had to Luther is the fact that he was such an advocate of the dissemination of Scripture among the masses. Does that, in fact, invalidate the sacred nature of Scripture because it's accessible very widely? Well, it's an issue at least to consider. But my point is about media is that inherently there is no, if you will, media in that sense is no different than any other art form. Every art form is suspect for the same reasons that media is suspect. But media, again, represents simply an intensification or a pushing of those issues, I think, much further in terms of our own habits of perception in our own time. That's another way to say it. I'll conclude this point by simply saying, to that extent, all art aspires to ritual and all art aspires to the sacred. But in fact, no art is ultimately can ultimately replace the nature of truly sacred experience. Let me ask another question very briefly. What forms are appropriate to sacred ritual? By that I mean, ritual obviously is the expression of the divine pattern in physical terms that we can understand. What forms are appropriate? Is poetry appropriate to ritual? Is music? I mean, there was a time when music was part of the temple experience, but no longer is. Is dance appropriate? What is the value of the architectural stability of temples to the sacred experience? The Ark of the Covenant moved from place to place. Endowments initially in the Salt Lake Valley were given up on Ensign Peak. The first endowment in this dispensation, we know, was given in the upper room of Joseph Smith's store, and in fact was not a drama, but was a narrative piece, without the division of labor, if you will, in terms of dramatic parts. What inherently in the form of sacred ritual is essential to the sacredness of that ritual? I think that's a difficult question, and one that has not been fully explored within the framework of the Church, and I think Michael very provocatively raises that question by his attack on the media and its relationship to the sacred. Those are issues we've not looked at very carefully, even in the use of the film and the temple experience. Now, let me, if I may, make a third point and shift the ground slightly once again, which is also a response. It seems to me that Brother Hick's primary objections to the use of the media come down on the side of what is commonly known as propaganda. John Gardner, in an extraordinary book called On Moral Fiction, makes the distinction between art and propaganda in the following way, not using propaganda in necessarily a pejorative sense. He says that when one begins with a preconceived objective in mind and works methodically toward that objective, one is in fact creating a work of propaganda, speaking within the framework of the artistic enterprise with a small a. That is to say, one knows in advance what one is going to come up with, and one works to that end. Now, art is, in fact, a rather different kind of experience in and of itself. Art is, by nature, exploratory. It is, by nature, a discovery. It is by nature an act of faith, if you will. The artist embarking on a painting or the artist embarking on the creation of a motion picture, in the best sense of using the word artist, doesn't know where he or she is going to end up in terms of a final result. In fact, the very rationale for embarking on the creation of a work of art is the process of discovery one goes through to find out what one finds out at the end. It's not something that one knows in advance because it involves the use of the imagination as well as, and this is the terribly frightening thing, I think, to us Latter-day Saints, the engagement of one's deepest feelings in the practice of the art. Now, when one says deepest feelings, that means one's sins as well as one's virtues. And that's the terrifying thing to us, because when we engage both our sins and our virtues, and when the result is unpredictable, institutionally, that's an unacceptable risk. Now, that's only to say that institutionally, when we have approached the media, and my particular interest and background is in film, and film as an art form, not film as its use in advertising or in terms of broadcast or news or anything else. When we have approached the media, we have consistently taken the safe path. And by the safe path, I mean we have consistently fallen on the side of propaganda rather than on the side of the art form. How does that distinction relate to our perception of the sacred? If in fact art aspires, successfully or unsuccessfully, righteously or unrighteously, to the sacred, aspires to ritual, and I concede right readily that art is in that sense a secondary form, not a primary form of access to the sacred or to the divine, and we have fallen consistently on the side of propaganda in the church, what does that bespeak in terms of our yearning or our desire to make connection with the sacred through the form of any art, if you will, let alone the media? And obviously, then I come back to the question again, which forms are appropriate to the sacred? And it may in fact not be a question of which forms are appropriate, but it may be in fact a question of how those forms are used. Which brings me, I suppose, to my final point in reference to Brother Hicks' paper, which is the issue of content and form. I think Marshall McLuhan is absolutely wrong-headed. I mean, McLuhan uttered a number of extraordinarily provocative ideas, most of which were utter nonsense, but provocative nonetheless. But the medium, in fact, is not the message. The medium and the content, in fact, are fusions, or maybe fusions, in the hands of the finest sensibilities, and have the ability to transcend themselves. There are films, which I'm sure many of you know, that invite, if you will, a viewing that is as careful and thoughtful and rigorous as a line of poetry by Eliot, if you will, or by as a speech by Shakespeare. Now, those films, I grant you, are in the minority, but they nevertheless have been achieved. It seems to me that the great difficulty we face in the church is not that we have embraced the media as heartily as the world, but in fact, we have embraced the media in the most naive possible way and in the most distrustful possible way. We have been, if you will, in some sense, entirely too cautious in our use of the media rather than as exploratory and as dynamic and as faithful as we could be in our use of the media. Now, please don't infer from that that I believe the media has the power to save. I don't believe that. Only Christ in relationship to individual souls has the power to save. Not even the church in that regard has the power to save. But at the same time, I believe that we all have chosen vocations and chosen paths through which, and if you will, these are arenas through which we exercise our own faith and our own confidence in the kingdom of God. I think the media is no less respectable a field of endeavor than painting or poetry or teaching sociology or psychology or composing music. I only think we happen to have done it more badly than these other forms. My final comment is in fact one of enormous agreement with Brother Hicks, and it is his final quotation from the Doctrine and Covenants about he shall mount up in the imagination of his thoughts as upon eagle's wings. That, in my mind, opens an exploration that we have not even begun to think about in the church, and that is the relationship between imagination and faith. Those are twin subjects about which we seem to know virtually nothing in terms of their result. And our use of the media, either in sacred contexts or in profane contexts, or in our yearning for the sacred, we don't understand what it means to have an imagination that is essentially a faithful imagination, and yet one that is free, as the image of the eagle suggests. We tend to think rather in terms of the restrictions placed on our imagination. That suggests to me that we have a great distance to go in terms of learning what the gospel is about and what the true nature of freedom, both in ritualistic expression and also in artistic expression, is about. My hope is that others like Michael will continue to call our attention to the fact that we have indeed subverted our own best hopes in favor of a rather clean and rather antiseptic kind of propaganda in the church that delivers neither the sacred nor, in fact, in some sense, the profane, but rather, in John's words, probably is only lukewarm and deserves to be spewed out of our mouths. Thank you.